Hey, it's Tony Bruschi, and this is our Week in Review. Over the weekend, taking a look back at some of the most compelling conversations and stories that we've covered for you of the last week. Brand new episodes back Monday morning, bright and early, 5 a.m. here on the podcast.
This is a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Welcome back to our continuing coverage of the sentencing of Lori Vallow Daybell and victim impact statements in the courtroom. Let's go back there now.
Okay, we're back on the record on KCR 2221-1624, State of Idaho versus Lori Noreen Vallow. This is the sentencing hearing. We took a mid-morning break. The state concluded its sentencing recommendations, and the defense may now present theirs. The court would also thank everyone for complying with the conduct order in effect and not having any disturbances throughout the morning. I appreciate everyone continuing to comply with that order. With that in mind, then, Mr. Thomas, is the defense ready to present their recommendations?
We are, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Thomas, you can proceed.
The court prefer if I stand, or is it okay for me to sit, given the acoustics in the room?
I think it would probably be better if you remain seated to pick up the recording on the record.
Very good, Your Honor. Thank you. Your Honor, some 20 years ago, I was sworn into the bar and took a sacred oath to uphold the Constitution. And part of upholding that Constitution is making sure that the state meets their burden on criminal cases. They're required to prove beyond a reasonable doubt every aspect of the case. And I used to be a prosecutor back in the day, 20 years ago. I understand the burden and I understand the weight that they carry. I enjoyed the job, but it was a bit of a commute. And after a couple of years, I found a job that was closer to home, gave me a little more opportunity to be with my family. And so I took the job, but I was going to be a job as a public defender. And it was hard. I was torn. Because people would come to me and they would say, you know, how can you do that? How can you represent people that are charged with such horrible and terrible things? And so I went to my wife, one of my best and greatest counselors, and I said, what do you think of all this? And she told me, John, I don't think Jesus Christ was a prosecutor. He is our greatest advocate. And I sit beside Lori Vallow and I hope and pray for words that he would have me say. And so I've reflected upon this day and this hour for a long time, several weeks. And the message that I think I need to tell the court and the recommendation that I need to give to the court regarding Ms. Vallow is a message of peace and love and joy and hope. First of all, peace. There are so many victims in this case. So many lives have been touched in the negative way. There is devastation and destruction surrounding this case, 3 deaths. And my heart aches. It truly does, as does the rest of my team, Jim and Brandon and all of our experts. We ache with the victims in this case. There's a lot of hurt surrounding this case, and not just the direct victims. As the court is well aware, there are cousins and uncles and aunts and people just in the general public who have been touched by this case. And that hurt can sometimes be manifest as hate. And I think that Lori Daybell is probably the most hated woman in America right now, and maybe in the world. But that hate will never bring closure to the victims. That hate will never bring about the healing to those who are hurt by this case. And hate will never bring about peace. Martin Luther King Jr. once said that hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. So how do we stop the hurt and the pain and the loss? And I've heard from a number of people today who've talked about JJ never being able to reach his milestones or his 21st birthday, or we wouldn't know what Tylee was going to be when she grew up. We'll never see her playing in the front yard with her children. We'll never know. We'll never know what Tammy's students make of themselves as they grow up. But we need peace to replace the hurt. And that peace and that healing will only come about by love and compassion. And I hope that each person that's touched by this case, whether they're a family member or a friend or just someone who has followed this case from the beginning, I hope they can heal and find some semblance of peace again, because this world needs peace. Which brings me to love. And I think that's how we're going to get back to peace. And Lori, if she could speak to each one of those people who have been hurt by this case or been affected by this case in a negative way, her message would be one of love. Her motto is, love is the key. And Lori's a very misunderstood person. People that know her, and I mean really know her, get the chance to know her the way that I did, the way that her family knows her, they would know that she is about love. Now, Lori and I didn't always get along. Our team has had tension and frustration and a lot of misunderstanding. But overwhelmingly, an overarching concept behind Lori and everything that she says to us and everything that she does is love. So if you get to know Lori, you'd find that she's a very different person than she plays on TV. She's kind, she's loving, she's caring, she's very witty, she's insightful, she's smart. And if you talk to people that knew her prior to 2018, prior to this whole crazy event, series of events, you'll hear about a wonderful person who is active in her church, who was active in her community, who loved her children, very active in their lives. You'll hear people who talk about how great she was with their children in her church, in her church callings, in her neighborhood. She was a great mother to her kids. Her son, Colby, in fact, testified at trial that she was a great mother when he was growing up. She has redeeming values. Kay Woodcock sang her praises today, that Lori was a great mom and that Kay allowed JJ, Kanan, to be adopted by Lori and Charles. And there's a lot of confusion and there's a lot of misunderstanding about how this ultimately came to pass. And that's probably not going to change anytime soon. There will be a lot of misunderstanding and a lot of confusion for a while. This brings me to my last topic of healing, and that is of hope. So what is hope? Well, hope is defined as a feeling of expectation and desire for a certain thing to happen. So what do we want to happen in this case? I think the court is well aware of the four goals of sentencing pursuant to Idaho Code 19-25-21. The first and foremost is the protection of society. The second most important is rehabilitation and then deterrence of the individual and the public generally. And finally, the least important, according to statute, is that of punishment. Now, first-degree murder is first-degree murder, and conspiracy carries the same punishment. Under Title 18-4004, and I quote, the court shall impose a life sentence with a minimum period of confinement of not less than 10 years, during which the period of confinement of the offender shall not be eligible for parole or discharge or credit or reduction of sentence for good conduct, except for meritorious service. So those are the two guiding principles that we have to look at. And I know the court's well aware of this. This isn't necessarily for the court's edification. But I think we have to think about how are we going to heal the hurt and the pain and the devastation of this case with hope? How do we reconcile the four goals of sentencing in Idaho Code 19-25-21 and the requirements of punishment in 18-4004 with hope? Well, we, and collectively I'm talking about the court, the prosecution, and the defense collectively, have saved the life of the defendant. I don't think the court, nor the prosecution, or the defense team should take credit or blame for the death penalty being taken off the table as a possible punishment. In my opinion, it was a collective effort, an effort that led to the court's decision. It was a necessary outcome to a series of events that no one person can be credited or blamed. We saved her life. And that is a win. That's a win for all humanity. So now what do we do? Court can, as the state requests, find a sentence appropriate of fixed life without parole. That certainly meets the protection of society and punishment, the first and last goals of sentencing. However, if the court so chooses, the court can also give the defendant a fixed term of years to serve in prison, followed by an indeterminate term of life. And after great deliberation and thought, we would ask the court to sentence Ms. Vallo Daybell to a 20-year fixed term with an indeterminate term of life. We believe that that meets all the goals of sentencing with an added bonus of hope. So why would we give the defendant any hope at all? Are we rewarding her? I don't think so. It's not about her. Giving her hope, it's for us. It's for everyone in this courtroom. It's for everyone watching on the internet. It's for everyone who's going to watch this on television. It's for everyone who lives and breathes outside the walls of prison. Her hope will benefit society. In our opinion, if you give her fixed life, you will have essentially thrown her away. She has no incentive to rehabilitate. There is no deterrent to her or anyone else. The punishment portion is final and all-encompassing. However, if we give her hope, we protect society by keeping her behind bars well into her 70s, but she has the incentive to be a model prisoner. She has the incentive to help those women that she interacts with in prison. And over time, she changes her behavior, her routines become habits, and she helps other inmates. She becomes a better person. And as these inmates interact with her, this better version of Lori Daybell, they become better people as they re-enter society. So without hope, the likelihood of success in reaching any of the goals of sentencing other than punishment is very low, if not non-existent. Your Honor, we live in the greatest country in the world. We can do this. We can't bring JJ back. We will never reach those milestones. We can't bring Tylee back. She'll never have children of her own. And we can't bring Tammy back. She'll never visit with her grandkids or teach a young student in the library or in her computer class. But we can try to bring others up who go to prison to a higher level than they are when they went in. And I think that's important. And I think that's a testament to JJ and to Tylee and to Tammy. I think that gives them something to carry on in the future. Forgetting about Lori Daybell is not the way that we're going to heal. Remembering JJ, remembering Tylee, remembering Tammy, and allowing Lori to be the best person that she can be in a prison setting, to help other people in that prison setting. That's how we're going to get the benefit out of Lori. The benefit to society of giving Lori Daybell hope far outweighs any detriment. And what do we have to lose by giving a woman in her 70s an opportunity to go before a parole board and to ask for release? There's not even any guarantee that she will be released in her 70s. But that hope is what's going to drive progress in this case. So in summation, we need to heal in order to have peace. Peace comes through love. Love is manifested in this case through hope. We ask the court to show mercy and look to the future. We ask the court for a 20-year fixed term plus life indeterminate, concurrent for all 5 counts of murder and conspiracy to commit murder. We would ask the court to give Lori Daybell a 14-year concurrent sentence for the grand theft to run concurrent with each one of the other charges. We can do this, Judge. We can move forward towards peace again and heal, which is what we really need to do. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you for the recommendations, Mr. Thomas. All right, Ms. Vallow, before I impose sentence, if you choose, you may address the court. This is known as the right of allocution, which permits you to make a statement on your own behalf or present any information in mitigation of the punishment for the crimes you've committed. And let me inquire at this time, do you wish to address this court? All right, very well, you may make your statement.
I'd like to start by quoting John from the New Testament in the Bible. In John chapter 8, verse 7, Jesus says, "He that is without sin among you, let him first cast a stone at her." Then in verse 15, Jesus says, "Ye judge after the flesh, I judge no man. And yet if I judge, my judgment is true." Jesus knows me. And Jesus understands me. I mourn with all of you who mourn, my children and Tammy. Jesus Christ knows the truth of what happened here. Jesus Christ knows that no one was murdered in this case. Accidental deaths happen. Suicides happen. Fatal side effects from medications happen. I have a different perspective in life because in 2002, when I was pregnant with Tylee, I died in the hospital while in labor with her. They tried to stop my labor. They put me on the table and they put something in my IV and I felt my spirit falling to the floor. I was standing near my pregnant body watching the doctors try to revive me, which took them a few minutes. In that time, my sister Stacy was standing to my left. I turned to hug her and was surprised that her spirit was as tangible as a physical body because I knew I was in spirit and she was in spirit. She said she needed to show me some things and we went to heaven. I later returned to my body. Because of this experience, I have access to heaven and the spirit world. Since then, I have had many communications from people now living in heaven, including my children, Tylee Ashlin and Joshua Jackson, my sisters, Stacy and Lolly, my aunts and my uncles, and my grandparents. I have had many communications with Jesus Christ, the Savior of this world, and our heavenly parents. I have had many angelic visitors have come and communicated with me and even manifested themselves to me. Because of these communications, I know for a fact that my children are happy and busy in the spirit world. Because of my communications with my friend Tammy Daybell, I know that she is also very happy and extremely busy. I have always mourned the loss of my loved ones, and I have lost many in this mortal world. However, I know that more than most people, I know where they are now and what they're doing. I know how wonderful heaven is, and I'm homesick for it every single day. I know we all lived in heaven before we were born on earth, and we were all adult spirits in the heavenly realm. We chose to come to earth as mortals. Heaven is more wonderful than you can possibly imagine. I do not fear death, but I look forward to it. I did not want to return to my body when I was out of it. Even though my son Colby, who I adored more than anything, was only 6 years old at the time, and I was about to give birth to this new baby girl that I wanted so badly. I was a young mother, and you would think I wouldn't want to leave my children, but as I stood in heaven, I did not want to go back. I thought they would be fine without me because I was peaceful and I was happy and I was home. But then I was told by Jesus that I needed to go back and complete things that I had covenanted or promised to do before I was born. This caused me a lot of distress because I knew heaven was my real home and I only wanted to be there. I was free from pain, emotional and physical. But then I was shown how I would help my children and others in the future. So ultimately, I did agree to go back to my body. Tylee has visited me. She is happy and very busy. Tylee is free now from all the pains of her life. Tylee suffered horrible physical pain her whole life. I sat with Tylee in the hospital year after year after year while she screamed in pain when the morphine wasn't even enough to take away the pain of her pancreatitis. I sat there while she cried and I held back her hair while she threw up. And I am the only person on this earth who knows how much Tylee suffered in her life. She had pain every single day. She never felt good. Her body did not work right. And I don't know if that was from complications from me dying while she was being born or something else, but she had a very difficult life. She was sexually abused by her own biological father since she was 3 years old, and she was forced by family court to go visit him for 10 years against her will. I fought for her in court. I protected her. I tried to protect her with my whole life. I tried to protect her. I worried about her every single day. Tylee had to get her GED because she couldn't go to school every day because she never felt good. She felt sick. Nobody knows this because Tylee, like myself, tries to put on a good front, tries to be a happy person, tries to have hope in life, tries to know that she's here for a purpose and that she has an eternal purpose to be on this earth. But I never stopped worrying about her. One of the times that Tylee came to me as a spirit after she died, she said, she commanded me and she said to me, "Stop worrying, Mom. We are fine." She knows how I worry and how I miss her. The first time JJ visited me after he passed away, he put his arm around me and he said to me, "You didn't do anything wrong, Mom. I love you. And I know you loved me every minute of my life." JJ, Joshua Jackson, was an adult spirit. And he was very, very tall when he put his arm around me. He is busy. He is engaged. He has jobs that he does there. And he is happy where he is. His life was short, but JJ's life was meaningful. JJ was a wonderful person and touched the lives of everyone. And I adored him every minute of his life. My eternal friend, Tammy Daybell, has visited me on several occasions. She came to bring me peace and comfort. And I know that she is extremely busy helping her family, especially her children and grandchildren. And I have a great love for Tammy. My beautiful children, Tylee Ashlyn and Joshua Jackson, rest safely this day in the arms of Jesus. My wonderful friend, Tammy Daybell, rest safely this day in the arms of Jesus. And I look forward to the day when we are all reunited and I too will rest with them in the arms of my Jesus.
All right, Ms. Vallow, thank you for your comments to the court. Let me ask you at this time, Ms. Vallow, are you fully satisfied with the representation you've received from your attorneys throughout this case?
Yes.
Thank you. All right, the court will conclude then with my own review of the matter and then pronounce sentence. Ms. Vallow, based on the jury's verdict of guilty in this case, it is the judgment of this court that you're guilty of the following counts of the amended indictment. Count one, conspiracy to commit first-degree murder of Tylee Ryan and grand theft by deception. Count two, first-degree murder of Tylee Ryan. Count three, conspiracy to commit first-degree murder of Joshua Jackson Vallow and grand theft by deception. Count four, first-degree murder of Joshua Jackson Vallow. Count five, conspiracy to commit first-degree murder of Tammy Daybell. And count seven, grand theft. We carefully reviewed the record of this case, beginning with your prior criminal history. Very notably, you're 50 years old. These are the first criminal convictions you've ever had. I will note, however, in addition to these convictions, you have two additional conspiracy to commit first-degree murder cases pending in Arizona. And it's somewhat incredible in this case that seeing you've gone from no criminal history in your life to now having been convicted of 2 counts of first-degree murder, 3 counts of conspiracy to commit first-degree murder, and you continue to face more additional counts of conspiracy to commit first-degree murder in another state. I've looked at the recommendations in the pre-sentence investigation report. It ultimately recommends a prison sentence stating, quote, incarceration under the custody of the Idaho Board of Correction. Normally, the court would have some additional information to rely on in fashioning its sentence, including the benefit of recommendations based on a gain evaluation, substance abuse report, mental health review, and other reports. However, you elected not to cooperate with the pre-sentence investigation. As I would note on page 23 of the pre-sentence investigation report, it states, quote, Lori Vallow Daybell intends to remain silent during the pre-sentence investigation process. She has the packet, but does not intend to answer any questions of evaluators or investigators. Quote, no attempts were made to complete the court-ordered screenings due to her refusal. I'm advising you that that was your choice to not cooperate in the pre-sentence investigation, but it left me without some additional information that potentially could have been mitigating in your case. And as I proceed with the sentencing, I'll note those deficiencies in the information I normally would have in a pre-sentence investigation report. As has been mentioned by both sides here, the court has to consider certain sentencing objectives when I sentence somebody, and these are set out in cases including State versus Toohill, which is a Court of Appeals case, 103 Idaho 565, and it's been adopted by our Supreme Court as well. And I have to consider 4 main objectives. Number 1, the protection of society, which is the primary objective. 2, deterrence of the individual and public generally. 3, possibility of rehabilitation. And 4, punishment or retribution for wrongdoing. That states, or case states, moreover, it's clear as a matter of policy in Idaho, the primary consideration is the good order and protection of society. All other factors must be subservient to that end. I've also reviewed and considered the criteria set forth in an Idaho statute, 1925-21, on the question of whether or not you should be confined to prison and to what extent. That statute sets out a variety of factors I have to consider in weighing whether a long prison term here would be appropriate. Some of the attorneys cited already to some of the provisions of that statute, and again, it talks about the primary consideration of the protection of society and also talks about the impact on the victim, the possibility of risk reduction through rehabilitation, and deterrence are also to be considered. There are some factors laid out in that statute that are not necessarily controlling, but weigh in favor against either imprisonment or, in this case, where imprisonment's required, an extensive imprisonment term. Some of those factors under Part 2 of this statute is the defendant's criminal conduct neither caused nor threatened harm, which is clearly not the case here, that the defendant did not contemplate the conduct would cause or threaten harm. Again, that would not apply here. The defendant's criminogenic needs indicate the defendant will benefit from supervision and treatment in the community. That's unavailable as community treatment can't occur with a minimum prison sentence required here. Another factor, were there substantial grounds tending to excuse or justify the defendant's criminal conduct, though failing to establish a defense? I don't find those apply given the facts of this case. Other factors, the victim of the defendant's criminal conduct induced or facilitated the commission of the crime. That did not occur here. Another part talks about compensation, which I don't find would be appropriate here other than on the grand theft charge. Part G, the defendant has no history of prior delinquency or criminal activity or has led a law-abiding life for a substantial period of time before the commission of the present crime. That is the single most mitigating factor I see in this case. Again, it's unbelievable that at your age, you have no prior criminal history, and now you sit here convicted of the most serious charges. I also have to consider whether the criminal conduct was the result of circumstances unlikely to recur. Based on the evidence in this case, and in particular, considering the statement you just made to the court, I find it weighs against me finding in mitigation for that factor. And then finally, the character and attitudes of the defendant indicate the commission of another crime is unlikely, or the defendant demonstrates amenability to treatment. So those are the mitigating factors. Then in aggravation, we have more factors to consider. Is there an undue risk that during the period of a suspended sentence or probation, the defendant would commit another crime harmful to another person? Would a lesser sentence depreciate the seriousness of the defendant's crime? Will imprisonment provide appropriate punishment and deterrent to the defendant? Will imprisonment provide an appropriate deterrent for other persons in the community? And a factor that would not apply here is the defendant a multiple offender or professional criminal. I don't have an LSI score, which is one value I can look at to help determine whether or not you'd be likely to reoffend. I don't have that because you wouldn't cooperate with the report. So considering here that you've lived a law-abiding life and for a long time, you were obviously a good mother, sister, daughter, and friend to many people. I have to take that into account. You've served a very long time of local jail, over 1,200 days, and the report is you've been a great inmate, never caused a problem for anyone in the jail. And you should be commended for that. And that also shows that you are capable of that. I believe your counsel, when they tell me you're an intelligent person, up until all these events began to transpire, you've achieved goals in your life, you've done important things in your life. And I'd note that despite some of the comments here today, I have found that during my interactions with you throughout this long case, including your trial, you've been respectful of the court. Do we know what this beeping is that keeps going off? Sorry. All right. The court will next consider, and I think it must be considered in mitigation, that you do have mental health issues. I've dealt with those throughout the context of this case where there were commitment proceedings. I've reviewed those reports and have that personal information from having gone through the determinations of whether or not you were competent or fit to stand trial. The most current diagnosis the court has is from Dr. Watson from February of this year, states you suffer from, and I'll quote, delusional disorder, mixed type with bizarre content and hyper-religiosity, continuous and unspecified personality disorder with histrionic and narcissistic features. So obviously a very complex diagnosis that's been made here. Whether or not that can or how it would be treated, I think by all accounts is unknown at this time. I've reviewed your personal history, including statements from your own immediate family members, and it's clear that something radically changed in you that led you to where you are today. In a statement made in the pre-sentence investigation report, your mother stated it perhaps best and said that you are not now, quote, the person she knew. The record in this case, including all the evidence I observed during the jury trial, indicates that if it wasn't already occurring, that this relationship with the co-defendant seemed to be a catalyst for the change. At this point, I'll note that I will not be making comments on any other co-defendants in this case, as your co-defendant is currently presumed innocent and awaiting trial. In sum, there are significant mitigating factors the court has to consider here when I consider you and your life as a whole, and that does make the case difficult. Typically, when I see somebody to be sentenced and they don't have a prior criminal history, they're given opportunities to first prove themselves on probation or avoid a lengthy term of incarceration. However, of course, some crimes are so serious that even with mitigation, there is no other reasonable option except for a prison term and a long prison term. And sadly, you've been convicted of and have committed the most serious crimes possible. And those crimes also require an equally serious punishment. So this is the part where I will consider what I think are the factors in aggravation. I went through those factors in the statute that I look at, and as I'll explain, I find that five of those factors weigh against you and in favor of a lengthy period of imprisonment. First, the case itself. I'll discuss that. There was a lot of pretrial litigation in the case. You decided to take your case to a jury trial. I will state and emphasize that I firmly believe it's the right of every person in our country to exercise their right to a jury trial, and they're afforded the full due process of the law. It's been somewhat disheartening to me to realize that there are many people who think that they can predetermine a case and somebody shouldn't be afforded their full rights of due process before they are convicted of a crime. Well, I didn't make all of the rules that govern criminal cases, but I took an oath to uphold the rules that are there, and I make every effort to ensure that people's due process is protected because that's an important duty of mine. Everyone has a right to be presumed innocent, and everyone in the criminal case, in a criminal case, does have a right to a jury trial. Sometimes I feel like maybe too many cases settle, and there should be more trials because it's a right people are entitled to exercise. You exercise that right, and I in no way hold it against you that you decided to have your case determined by a jury. That's your right, and it does not impact or influence my decision in sentencing. Before trial, I did not delve into all of the evidence or facts of this case and only addressed those when necessary to make rulings on motions, because I wanted to keep objective through the proceedings and remain impartial. You were afforded all of your due process in this case, and ultimately, after presentation of the evidence, a jury did find you guilty on all counts. I bring that up now because when there is a trial, I learn and see all of the facts along with the jurors. And that's a different scenario than when someone enters a plea and I'm only allowing argument in a sentencing and not sitting through the evidence as I did here. Having considered all of the evidence that I saw at trial along with the jurors, it's been a difficult task for me to narrow down and articulate all of the aggravating factors because really there are so many here. Murder is the most serious offense. And the most unimaginable type of murder is to have a mother murdering her own children, and that's exactly what you did. You were involved in and guilty of conspiring to murder another group of children's mother, Tammy Daybell, who had children of her own. And despite the jury convicting you with overwhelming evidence, you still sit here before the court today and said you didn't do it. You came here to East Idaho, where I've spent my life, and moved here from another place already with plans in progress to make your children disappear. The evidence bore that out at trial. You removed your children from their home in Arizona, alienated them from friends and family, got rid of JJ's service dog. You moved to Rexburg, a community where you could find 1,000 random families to take your children, and you brought them here to murder them. You had so many other options. You could have gotten divorced. You could have found someone to take care of those kids. But as the state was able to prove at trial, you chose the most evil and destructive path possible. You killed those children, according to the state's theory, and I believe it, to remove them as obstacles and to profit financially. You justified all of this by going down a bizarre religious rabbit hole, and clearly you are still down there. While you were enjoying your new life in Hawaii, countless law enforcement officers, family members, and volunteers were searching for your children. And I don't think to this day you have any remorse for the effort and heartache you caused for others looked for your children when you knew where they were and knew they were dead. They were found dead, burned, mutilated, and dismembered, and buried like animals. After you knew they were dead, you collected public-funded assistance payments meant for them, and that was blood money you kept for yourself. And that's the grand theft charge you've been convicted of. Your sister, your son talked to you, begged with you while you were in the jail during phone calls I heard at trial. And those were very sad and difficult calls to hear. And you didn't provide any assistance or comfort to them. During the trial, when the evidence came out about how these children were found and the state they were in, you wanted to be excused and not have to watch the evidence, and were fine to let all the other people in the courtroom, including the jurors, have to bear through that. However, I ruled that you did have to sit and watch and see the result of your heinous crimes. The jurors in your case fulfilled their duty admirably. All 18 jurors we had, because we had alternates, went through the entire trial and faithfully fulfilled all their obligations and all the instructions. So we were able to get impartial jurors who weren't already tainted by pretrial publicity to decide your case. And I do thank the jurors publicly for the service they rendered. Those jurors, I noted during the trial, were very good at keeping their emotions in check and keeping stone-faced, as they're supposed to do, and be objective until the case is done and submitted. However, I did note at certain times during the trial, such as when there were videos and pictures shown of you in Hawaii at this time frame when JJ and Tylee were lying in shallow graves, the disgust on the faces of those jurors was evident. And shocking revelations about what happened here just kept coming through the trial. The crime scene was a horrific thing to have to review. And there's images that I will never get out of my mind. And I'm just looking at the pictures. Law enforcement officers who had to deal with the aftermath of what you did, I'm sure, were traumatized. And I know it was traumatic as well for the jurors who had to sit through and see the photographs of these dead and mutilated and buried children. For those people who loved and cared about JJ and Tylee and Tammy Daybell, to have to see those photographs of them through trial of their dead and desecrated bodies must have been devastating. Tammy Daybell was murdered as a result of your conspiracy. She was, by all accounts, a healthy, happy mother and wife through a lot of her life. And you were out shopping for wedding rings to marry her husband while she was still alive. You were planning a wedding to her husband while she was still alive. You haven't shown any remorse for any of those actions. And she ended up being murdered, buried, had to be disinterred later so an autopsy could be performed in order to prove the evidence of what you had done. She didn't deserve any of that. You took her life away. You destroyed that family, fractured it to the point where, in the information I've had through the PSI, there are relationships that will probably never be mended that have rippled as a result of what's happened. JJ and Tylee, of course, 7 years old, 16 years old, were separate people whose lives were cut way too short because of you. Never got to grow up and be adults. The family and friends who have provided their impact statements, of course, have stated it better than I could about who they were. And it is a loss for everyone that you took them away from this world. And it is the most shocking thing, really, I can imagine, is that a mother killed her own children and you simply have no remorse for it. Even sitting here today, there's no remorse for what you did. After all of this evidence through trial, you haven't shown any remorse. You haven't said you're sorry. You haven't done anything to seek leniency from this court. There's been a lot of people during trial and here who have explained the devastation you're responsible for, and you've forever altered the lives, not in a good way, for many, many people, destroying family relationships, taking people away that were loved, cared for, and needed. You may not believe to this day that you've done anything wrong, and you still may think you're justified by your religious beliefs for what happened here. I'm not here to judge that, but I don't believe that any God in any religion would want to have this happen, what happened here. And your crimes are heinous and egregious, and that alone can constitute a major aggravating factor that requires me to impose a serious length of incarceration. So after weighing all those factors, I need to, in aggravation, I find that the sentences I'm about to impose will serve the interest of justice by, number one, preventing you from ever doing this again, that they will not depreciate the seriousness of your crimes, will punish you appropriately, and will serve to deter both you and others. So that concludes the aggravating factors the court considered. At this time, then, I am prepared to pronounce sentence. Mr. Thomas, Mr. Archibald, and the defendant, would you please rise for the pronouncement of sentence? Based on all the relevant circumstances, including the evidence and recommendations presented in court today, it's the judgment of this court. Ms. Vallow, you'll be sentenced as follows. Well, first note, I'm going to take up the counts out of order as I want to address the substantive murder sentences first. So on count two, the charge you were convicted of, the first degree murder of Tylee Ryan, you are sentenced to the custody of the State Board of Corrections to serve the maximum allowed sentence, a fixed determinate term of life imprisonment with no possibility of parole. On count four, the charge of the first degree murder of Joshua Jackson Vallow, you are sentenced to the custody of the State Board of Corrections to serve the maximum allowed sentence, a fixed determinate life imprisonment sentence with no possibility of parole. I'll next address the three conspiracy counts you've been convicted of. And note, under Idaho Code 18-1701, the punishment for those crimes is the same as the underlying offenses you combined to commit. One of the offenses you combined to commit was first-degree murder, so those may be punishable also by imprisonment for life. When I look at what the appropriate sentences should be for the conspiracy charges, at first I wondered if they should be as long of a term or serious as the substantive murder charges. However, what I've concluded is that these conspiracy convictions merit the same grave punishment for several reasons. First, the conspiracies in which you engaged in have had far-reaching impacts on many people besides the deceased victims. And with what the court's heard, I am convinced that the conspiracy charges also merit the same serious sentence. So on count one, the conspiracy to commit first-degree murder of Tylee Ryan and grand theft by deception, you're sentenced to the custody of the State Board of Corrections to serve the maximum allowed sentence, a fixed determinate term of life imprisonment with no possibility of parole. And count three, the conspiracy to commit first-degree murder of Joshua Jackson Vallow and grand theft by deception, you're sentenced to the custody of the State Board of Corrections to serve the maximum allowed sentence, a fixed determinate term of life imprisonment with no possibility of parole. And on count five, the conspiracy to commit the first degree murder of Tammy Daybell, you're sentenced to the custody of the State Board of Corrections to serve the maximum allowed sentence, a fixed determinate term of life imprisonment with no possibility of parole. Finally, the court will address count seven, which is the charge of grand theft. On that charge, court is going to sentence you to a fixed determinate term of 5 years of prison, followed by an indeterminate term of 5 years of prison for a total 10-year term of imprisonment on the grand theft. Court will next consider whether sentences should be imposed consecutively or concurrently. I'm a pragmatic person, and I've struggled with the point of a consecutive sentence when in Idaho, a life sentence is just that, a life sentence without parole. And I've thought it through. However, when I looked at this case and the more I thought about it, I've determined that because there are three separate murders with three separate victims that occurred at three separate times, then running counts concurrently would not serve the interests of justice because those crimes all need to be taken into account separately and distinctly and individually. And you need to be held accountable separately for each of the three murders. So on those counts, the court will run consecutively the count two murder of Tylee Ryan, consecutive to count four, the murder of Joshua Jackson Vallow, and count five will run consecutive to count two and four, the conspiracy to commit first-degree murder of Tamara Tammy Daybell. So three consecutive life terms of prison. The remaining counts will be concurrent to the counts that are consecutive. The court will impose fines as requested by the state in the amount of $25,000 for all counts except the grand theft. On the grand theft, the fine will be in the amount of $1,000. The court will assess the civil penalty that was requested, and I find it's appropriate under Idaho Code 19-5307 of $5,000 per victim on each of the three victims as a civil penalty. And then finally, the restitution, which was requested by the state. Mr. Wood, if you could reiterate that number, $22,000, of what the restitution term is. And I want to inquire if there's any other restitution being sought by the state.
Thank you, Your Honor. I believe I said $22,545. And the state would ask for an additional 30 days to submit any further restitution for the victims, living victims who have been deemed as such by this court.
The court will assess that restitution on the grand theft charge of $22,545 as shown through the evidence at trial. And the court will allow 30 days for additional restitution requests, but that will be waived if it's not submitted timely. That'll conclude the court's sentencing on the charges. Mr. Thomas, do you have any questions on the sentence?
No, Your Honor, thank you.
All right, Mr. Wood, do you have any questions?
No, thank you.
All right, counsel, before we conclude, and Ms. Vallow, importantly, I need to advise you of the rights you have now. You do have the right to appeal to the Idaho Supreme Court from this judgment of conviction, and you have a right to be represented by an attorney if you appeal. You're also advised if you can't afford an attorney, an attorney will be appointed for you at public expense, and you only have 42 days to file an appeal. You also have the right to seek relief from my judgment under Idaho Criminal Rule 35. You have 120 days to file that motion if you believe a correction or reduction of this sentence is appropriate because it was either illegal or too harsh. And finally, you may also have rights to seek relief under the Idaho Uniform Post-Conviction Relief Act. Those actions have to be filed within 1 year from the day your right to appeal expires. Do you understand those appellate rights? All right, she acknowledged yes. The defendant will be required to submit DNA samples upon remand to the Idaho Department of Corrections. I'll ask the attorneys to please turn in any copies of the pre-sentence investigation reports or addenda so those can be kept in confidence and additional copies will be destroyed. And Ms. Vallow-Daybell, you are hereby remanded to the custody of the Sheriff of Fremont County to be delivered to the proper authorities of the Idaho Department of Corrections for execution of this sentence. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. That'll conclude our sentencing hearing.
There you have it, the sentencing of Lori Vallow Daybell in a very bizarre statement made by her. We can see just how delusional she is by that representation today. Sentenced now to life in prison without the possibility of parole for the murder of her two children and the conspiracy death of her husband's ex-wife, Tammy Daybell. Lori now faces extradition to Arizona to face charges there for yet another murder, the death of Charles Vallow, her former husband. There is much more to come in this case, including the trial of Chad Daybell. Be sure to press subscribe so you don't miss any of our continuing coverage in the Daybell saga. My name is Tony Bruschi. Stay with us.
This has been a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
This is an examination of the hidden human condition.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast.
The Hidden Killers podcast
with Tony Bruschi.